WMFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Pre-recorded.
Thank you, Digital Henry. Good morning. It's the 3rd of March, 2021. My name is Arthur, and this is the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org in Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. I'm going to start the show off with episode 62 of Suspense, titled Lazarus Walks, with an original air date of the 19th of October, 1943. Thanks for listening.
Nations, we present one of America's top spine tinglers, a radio rebroadcast of a program dedicated to the mysterious, the unusual, and sometimes the supernatural. A program of suspense.
This is the truth. Do you understand? The truth. It must be the truth. It has to be. I, Robert Winsley Graham, a doctor and psychiatrist by profession, do hereby, of my own free will and volition, albeit with deepest regret, make the following full and complete statement relative to that all but unbelievable series of events which has brought such disaster and misfortune to my house. Particularly to my poor wife, Isabel. It had its beginning, properly speaking, some 2 months ago, to be exact, on the evening of July 25th. We were in the drawing room, Isabel at the piano, practicing, as she said. Her Aunt Jane and I on the opposite sides of the room.
Isabel, what's the matter?
I don't know. I can't seem to keep my mind on anything anymore, even my music. Nerves.
Nerves.
Isabel.
Yes, Robert.
I don't wish to distress you, but it's going on for quite a little while now. It's not getting any better.
I know. Let's not discuss it, shall we?
Wish you'd let me prescribe treatment for you.
I could prescribe something for her.
You can do remarkable things now with just the common old drugs under proper control.
Drugs. It's not drugs that she needs. It's to get out of this house for a while. It's to get back to the concert stage where she belongs. It's work.
Aunt Jane, please.
I'm sorry. I don't believe in beating around the bush. You're an artist. You've got talent. There's no sense in your trying to subordinate yourself to somebody else.
Aunt Jane, that's enough. I'm not subordinating myself to anyone.
Really, Aunt Jane, you mustn't interfere, you know.
Robert doesn't want me to go back on the stage.
Darling, it isn't that I don't want you to go back. I'm proud of you. You know that. It's only because I think... because I know that going back to a professional career in your present mental condition would be terribly harmful.
I know, Robert. I know, you're right.
Oh, after all, I'm a doctor. It's my business to know these things. I get it. Probably the hospital.
Hello. Hello. Yes, it's Dr. Graham. Oh, yes. It's for... Who? Well, when would you like to see me? All right. Fine. No, not a trouble at all. Well, I'll be expecting you. Goodbye.
Isabel, good heavens.
Who do you suppose that was?
Who?
Roger Holcomb. Do you remember the case?
Roger Holcomb? I remember it.
Of course you do. The fellow was brought back from the dead, as the newspapers put it, about a year ago.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he really was dead for four full minutes, as far as medical science was concerned. Then Bates brought him around. It was 9 days' wonder at the time.
Well, what did he want to see you about?
I don't know. Something to do with his experience, obviously. He was in a terribly agitated state. Poor fellow had been walking up and down in front of the house for an hour, trying to get up courage to ring the bell. Finally, he phoned from the corner drugstore.
Why, the poor man. Why in the world should he do that?
Anxiety neurosis. They hounded him, you know, in the most shocking way. Got out of the hospital. Preachers and spiritualists, movie agents, just plain fakers. People trying to find out if he remembered anything of the 4 minutes. He's supposed to be dead. People just trying to exploit him. Oh, must be Holcomb now. Take him into the office.
Dr. Graham?
Yes, you're Roger Holcomb?
Yes.
Come in. Thank you. Pleasure to meet you, Mr. Holcomb.
Yes, sir.
You come this way, please, my office. Now just sit down anywhere. Lie down on the couch if you like. You're tired.
I am tired. Tired unto death.
Give me your hand, please.
For heaven's sake, there's nothing wrong with my pulse. If that's all you think it is, I'll go.
Why did you come to me, Mr. Holcomb?
You know my history.
Yes, most medical men do. Up until your disappearance.
Yeah, most medical men do, all right. Then they tell me I'm crazy.
Do you think you are, Mr. Holcomb?
Oh, I see. You're like all the rest. Let go of me, please.
Just a minute, right. Mr. Holcomb. You came to me for advice. For treatment. I suggest you tell me your story.
Well, I was told you specialize in strange cases.
Hmm.
Things that other men can't explain.
And that's true in a way.
Oh, you know what happened when I got out of the hospital.
Yes. They
followed me, questioned me, hounded me day and night, trying to find out if I remembered anything, if I'd experienced anything beyond the grave.
Yes, I remember that.
Well, then you remember that my answer was always the same. That I remembered nothing, that I knew nothing. Well... I was wrong.
Oh? What did you experience during those 4 minutes?
I don't know. But it must have been something. Something I don't even dare to think about.
How do you know this?
Well, it happened the first time on a boat trip, which I'd taken to recover my health. I found myself chatting with a woman who was seated at my table in the dining saloon. She found occasion, as such women often will, to mention her age. She said, "After all, I'm not yet 40. And then... it happened.
What happened?
Well, from somewhere came crashing into my mind a certain knowledge of the exact day and year of that woman's birth. Mm-hmm. And with it, a compulsion to speak out. A compulsion which I could no more have resisted than I could have resisted breathing. I said, "Madam, you were born in May, weren't you? May 30th. And she looked at me in utter astonishment. We'd never even seen each other before in our lives. And said, "Yes." And then I added the date, the year... 1900. See, she was well over 40. She'd lied to me. Innocent enough thing, but I had known the truth. And I'd been forced to speak it. And I have been ever since.
This phenomenon has occurred often?
More times than I can remember. Every time a direct lie, no matter how trivial, is uttered in my presence, I suddenly know the answer to that lie. I know the truth. And I'm compelled to speak it.
Condition has existed only since your...
Since my 4 minutes beyond the grave, yes.
Quite.
It's as though in that brief time I glimpsed eternity. If I'd seen revealed all truth of all the ages. I can never tell you how horrible that thing. I found that men, even the most honest of men, live by lies.
Tell me. You have a family, friends who are understanding?
Oh, for heaven's sake, Doctor, don't you understand what this has done to me? Yes, I had a family and friends. A girl I was going to marry. Today I'm an outcast, pariah. I'm shunned, feared. I'm hated. Yes, hated.
Mr. Holcomb. Mr. Holcomb, I believe that this condition is very real to you. It causes you very real anguish. I want to help you.
Do you think you can, Doc?
I'm confident that I can. Suppose you could arrange to stay with me here at my home for a matter of weeks or months, if necessary.
Well, I'll do anything. Good. Anything in the world to be a normal man again, but...
But what?
Dr. Graham, I can see that you still don't believe me.
Oh, no.
I beg of you. You don't know the terrible responsibility I'd be to you. I'd be like a spy, like some inexorable prosecutor from another world.
Mr. Holcomb, let me worry about that.
All right. Is there anyone else in your household who might object?
Oh, no, there's only my wife and her aunt. Have your own quarters. Be quite comfortable, I assure you.
I'm sure I'd be. It's a lovely house that I've seen of it.
Yes, I'm rather lucky. I'm interested in research primarily. Not much money in that, you know, but a couple of years ago I came into quite a nice inheritance. The house went with it. What is it? What's the matter?
The inheritance was not yours. It was your wife's. The house is your wife's. You were penniless.
That's true. I don't know why I lied to you. Pride, I suppose.
I'm sorry. I told you I couldn't help it.
No.
I'll go now.
Please. Mr. Holcomb, my fault is a small matter.
But you see now that I
want to help you.
Do you believe me now?
I believe, Mr. Holcomb, either that you are far more ill than I realized, or that in months to come, you and I must venture into a realm never before explored by mortal man. It was utterly fantastic, yet it was true. I checked the facts again and again. He could not possibly have known, and yet he knew. Could you imagine what this meant to a man of science? If I could fathom the depths of Roger Holcomb's mind, I could make a contribution to the body of scientific knowledge absolutely without parallel in modern times. I'd be more famous than Pasteur or Ehrlich. There remained the problem of Isabel. I was aware of the danger, of course. I was acutely aware of the peculiarly delicate balance of her mind at that time. But the fact that the presence of a man like Roger Holcomb might be seriously detrimental to my rather well-conceived plans for Isabel. I believed I could control the situation. I determined to proceed. Actually, Holcomb's presence made itself felt almost immediately. The first incident came after he'd been with us.
Isabel, please stop that playing and listen to me.
Aunt Jane, you know Robert has said I mustn't talk about it, that it's bad for me.
I don't care what Robert said.
But he's my doctor and my husband.
And I'm not sure that he should be either.
Aunt Jane, I don't know much about psychiatry, but I do know that making trouble between a husband and a wife...
I'm not making anything that isn't there already, and you know it. Good heavens, girl. Look at yourself. Look what's happened to you since your marriage.
I've been sick.
He's made you sick.
That's ridiculous.
Maybe it's just that he's afraid of losing you. Maybe he's even afraid of losing your money. But I'm absolutely convinced that whether he's meant to or not, he's made you believe there's something the matter with you that isn't.
Aunt Jane, I simply forbid you to talk this way.
And now he brings this psychopath into the house.
And don't bring Roger into it. He's Robert's patient. It's Robert's work and it's none of our business.
What about your own work?
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter?
Aunt Jane, you simply don't understand. Robert is my husband. I trust him and I love him. Nothing can ever come between us. I'd destroy anything. I'd kill anyone who tried.
Isabel. Isabel, do something before it's too late.
Do what?
Get away. Leave him. Divorce him. Anything.
Oh, I hope we're not interrupting.
Of course not, darling. Hello, Roger.
Hello, Isabel.
Good afternoon.
How are you feeling, Roger?
I'm better, I think.
I think it would be better if we didn't discuss our states of mind, Isabel.
Oh, of course, I'm sorry. Well, would you like me to play something for you? You know, I think I'm beginning to get the feel of it again. Really, I do.
You're sure we haven't interrupted some conversation?
Of course not. We were just discussing how helpful you've been in getting Isabel back to her work again.
Roger.
No. No, you were not. You were telling Isabel to divorce her husband.
Isabel.
I'm sorry.
Roger, come back.
Isabel, is that true?
You brought him in here deliberately.
Is that true?
It doesn't matter, I suppose. You've known how I felt for a long time.
Yes, I'm afraid I have.
Robert, it was all so silly. She didn't mean it. It was just
I did mean it.
But I did mean it. I'm sorry, Isabel. But I've been under this roof too long as it is.
Oh, Jane, you're not leaving us.
It's theft, Isabel.
Yes. Yes, I think it's unquestionably best. Best that you go at once. She left us, of course. I'd always believed that Jane exercised an unfortunate influence over Isabel. I did not dream it had reached such a point as this. Yet this incident gave me my first insight into the relationship which was destined to develop between Isabel Roger and myself. The first and most obvious result was that within a matter of weeks, Isabel was to lose every friend she had. We became further estranged as each day passed. It was difficult to speak of even the most casual things with this strangely terrifying specter of truth, always at our elbow. The situation reached its inevitable climax the evening that Leopold Sierinski, the famous conductor of the Los Angeles Symphony, was to call on Isabel with a view to resumption of her professional career under his auspices. I gave a great deal of thought to that evening. It had to be handled with a great...
Robert, you will help me, won't you?
Of course I will, darling.
I don't know whether you realize how important it is to me. I have nothing but the music now. I've been working so hard. Playing sometimes half the night
while
you were asleep.
I've heard you.
Sometimes it seems that the piano's all that's helping me to keep my sanity.
My darling, I want you to let me prescribe something for you. It's time we face this thing, your trouble, I mean.
Robert, does he have to have dinner with us tonight?
Roger... Isabel, you know how I stand on that.
Oh, yes, but just
Even once, Isabel, keep him in his room like a spoiled child and we have guests. Isabel, it might undo everything I've accomplished in weeks.
Oh, of course. You're right. But...
Roger, come in.
Robert, I was wondering if I mightn't be excused just a night.
Oh, you're having dinner with us, Roger.
Must I?
You know you must, Roger, and you know why.
Why, Roger, don't you want to meet the great Leopold Sierinski? He's really a wonderful person.
Yes, indeed, I would very much.
But... You know, I made my debut with him in 1934. I did a concert with him every year until I...
Isabel was very talented, you know.
I was? I am. Oh, Roger, I'm going to play with him again. He wants me to open the season in November. Can you imagine what that means to me?
I'm so glad, Isabel.
And Robert has finally given his consent. Haven't you, dear?
I'm sorry. What was it you said, Isabel?
I said you'd given your consent to my playing with Sierinski.
Well, Isabel, you know I don't want you to think that I'd ever stand in your way.
I know, dear. Roger, I'll do the Emperor Concerto, and you will come to hear me. You do want to, don't you, Roger?
Please, Isabel, don't ask things of me that can't...
What's the matter? What's the matter with both of you? You act as though you thought I wouldn't be able to appear. As though the whole idea were hopeless or something.
Isabel, please.
I am going to play. I'll be better than I ever was. You know I will, don't you? Don't you?
Yes, of course, Isabel. You play wonderfully. Roger.
No, Robert. You're very certain that Isabel will be prevented from ever playing again by death.
Death.
Oh, Isabel, forgive me, please.
By death? No. Oh, no. Please, Roger, it's not true. Tell me it isn't. Roger, answer me. Answer me. Roger, do you hear me? Answer me. Answer me!
When Sierinski arrived, I told him it would be quite impossible for Isabel to leave her room. The concert was canceled, and indeed, to my knowledge, she's never touched the piano since that day. By now, to even the most casual observer, it must appear only natural that Isabel had every motive for a desperate, almost paranoid hatred of Roger Holcomb. This much was clear to me. The rest, not yet. But one thing, from any point of view, was certain. I had to keep Roger and Isabel apart. Perhaps what I feared was indeed inevitable. I honestly did not think it so at the time. As a precautionary measure, however, I prescribed a drug for Isabel, which she at last consented to take. I gave her own supply. She administered it to herself, as I had directed.
Roger? Roger?
Yes?
It's Isabel.
What do you want?
Let me in, please.
No.
Please, it's terribly important.
Robert said that
I know. But he said it would be all right this time.
You sure?
Yes. Yes, please.
All right.
Now, what do you want?
I want to talk to you, that's all.
What about it that's so important?
Roger, why don't you ever leave your room anymore?
Can't you guess?
Do you think I hate you?
Isabel, I don't know what to think anymore.
You do, don't you?
I warned him. I told him it would happen. Now I'm going mad up here thinking of the anguish I've caused you.
But, Roger, I don't. You must believe me.
I know what it's been like for you having me here.
Roger, you see, for the first time in my life, I think my husband is wrong about something.
Wrong?
Yes. Don't you see? He's been worried about both of us. And so this distrust has grown up between us.
Well, I don't distrust you, Isabel. You've been more wonderful to me than I'm.
But you're afraid of me. And that amounts to the same thing. And it's bad for the both of us. It's hurting both of us.
Well, I've often felt I wanted to talk to you, to beg your pardon.
Oh, you don't have to do that. We're both sick. But I think if we saw each other sometimes, if we talked the whole thing out, it would help us both.
Well, does Robert think so, too?
No.
Then he didn't tell you it was all right to see me.
No. I lied to you.
You what?
I lied to you.
You lied to me. And it didn't happen. Isabel, don't you see? I am getting well. It didn't happen.
I know. I don't think it does happen anymore. Except with Robert.
With Robert? What makes you think
I don't know. Something about the way he acts. The way he is.
Oh, but Isabel, he is curing me. Then perhaps you shouldn't have
come. No, don't you understand? We must see each other. We must talk.
No, listen. Isabel. Robert, something's happened that I must
please,
tell you
about.
Please,
you're completely overwrought.
Oh, but Robert, if
I must insist, Isabel, why did you do this?
I'm sorry.
You have to have a sedative right away. Isabel, get the bottle from your room.
Mine?
Yes, please, hurry.
All right.
Robert, she lied to me.
Yes, I know. But, Roger, I must absolutely forbid you to talk now. You must trust me.
All right, but later I want to have a long talk with you.
Of course we shall.
Here it is. I brought my hypodermic, too.
I'm glad you did. The other one's mislaid somewhere. Will you give it to him, please?
I?
Yes, I'm sorry, but this has upset me rather badly. My hands are shaking.
Robert, I'm terribly sorry.
No matter now, give him the hypodermic, the upper arm.
That's right.
There.
Thank you. Leave us now, please, Isabel.
All right.
How are you feeling now, Roger?
Well, I'm fine, Robert. I think I'm better than I've been in months.
I know you're better. That's why I was so upset to see you.
Why, Robert?
Can't tell you all my reasons now, but you must trust me and believe in me.
Oh, I do, but...
Only that I'm afraid for your health. Roger.
No. You're afraid of murder.
What?
Murder.
Roger, listen to me. Roger.
Murder.
Roger, what are you talking about? Roger! Roger! It was clear to me now. I knew I must take immediate action. I knew that the most terrible consequences might result if Isabel were alone with Roger, even for a moment. But he knew that he'd said so. There was no other explanation. I thought it through most carefully. And yet no plans are perfect. No man is infallible. Isabel!
Robert, frightened.
What are you doing?
Nothing.
Don't lie to me, Isabel.
I'm not.
You were coming from Roger's room.
No, I swear I won't.
Isabel, don't you understand that you're sick? That I've insisted on these things for your own good and his.
All right. I was going to talk to him, but I haven't.
Oh, Isabel. Why do you try to tell me that?
But it's true, Robert. Really true.
Is it? Roger? Roger?
What's the matter?
Look.
Robert. No, it couldn't be.
It is. He's dead.
Dead?
Hypodermic by his side. The drug, your hypodermic.
But it's only a sedative.
Except that in large enough quantity, it's fatal. You knew that.
Oh, Robert, don't listen to
me. Isabel, why? Why, I warned you.
Robert, look at me. It's Isabel. It's your wife. You can't... Oh, no. Where are you going? Come back.
I'm going to call the police. It was perhaps the most terrible decision a man ever had to make, even though it did come not as a shock to me, even from my point of view as a scientist. It was terrible enough. Yet it had to be done, and I had done it. I did not speak to her as we waited, and she made no further attempt to appeal to me. She seemed utterly stupefied, perhaps as a result of the drug she'd herself been taking. Perhaps because she suddenly realized she was hopelessly trapped. When police arrived, I told the story with as little emotion.
Yes, there are fingerprints, all right, on both the bottles.
Those would be my wife's, of course. They both belong to her.
Is that true, Mrs. Graham?
Yes.
Dr. Graham, do I understand, then, that you are formally charging your wife for the murder of Roger Holcomb?
Well, you could hardly expect me to do that, could you, Inspector? I'm simply telling you the facts.
Yes, but you said she hated Holcomb, and you knew it.
My wife has been mentally ill for some time. There are many people who can testify to that. You plead insanity, of course.
Dr. Graham, I can't tell you how sorry I am, but the things you have told me add up to only one thing, that you yourself obviously recognize.
Yes.
Your wife, Isabel Graham, murdered Roger Holcomb.
What did you say?
I said your wife, Isabel Graham, murdered Roger Holcomb.
No. I murdered him.
What?
I tried to make it appear that Isabel had done it. And I succeeded. But I killed him. Man is infallible. Yes, I killed Roger Holcomb. And he himself revealed the truth. I'd planned to dispose of Isabel for many months. I'd never loved her. I'd loved only science. I wanted her money, and Holcomb found it out. That was the risk I ran. But any chance lie in his presence, either by Isabel or myself, bring out the truth, and it did. I had no alternative once he'd discovered that. But to kill him, it's easy enough to throw the blame on Isabel. I had not counted on that terrible compulsion for the truth. That strange affliction of Roger Holcomb's and its power over me. Did it transfer itself at his death to me? Or was it conscience? It's a pity that it had to end this way. It was a fascinating case.
So closes Lazarus Walks, starring Orson Welles. Tonight's tale of suspense.
This rebroadcast is a presentation of the Armed Forces Radio Service.
Coping 19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
Managing today's uncertainty can be overwhelming. We crave security, and it's uncomfortable when we sense a lack of control over our lives. Develop a routine for a more balanced lifestyle with healthy habits and fun. Focus on what you can control, even if it's little things, like a before bedtime ritual.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Thank you, lads, and thank you, Ad Council, for that FCC obligation. For the first half of the program, we heard episode 62 of Suspense, Lazarus Walks, with an original air date of the 19th of October, 1943. I'm unsure if that was the stateside CBS broadcast air date, or, as we heard, it was rebroadcast for the Armed Service Radio Network. It did star an old Grandauer friend, Orson Welles. My name is Arthur, and this is the Grandauer here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. For the second half of the program, I'm going to play episode 27 of Frontier Gentlemen, The Catman. This had an original air date of the 10th of August, 1958. Thanks for listening.
I left Cheyenne without my luggage and in company with a wild Irishman and his even wilder cargo of freight.
Frontier Gentlemen. Herewith an Englishman's account of life and death in the West. As a reporter for the London Times, he writes his colorful and unusual stories. But as a man with a gun, he lives and becomes a part of the violent years in the new territories. In just a moment, we will bring you the latest report from the Frontier Gentleman. Whether your marriage license is brand new or your wedding ring is worn thin over the years, you'll get a kick out of every lighthearted episode of CBS Radio's The Couple Next Door. Written by Peg Lynch, creator of Ethel and Albert, The Couple Next Door is a warm and humorous series about a young married couple. Just for the fun of it, join us on most of these same stations 5 days a week as Peg Lynch and Alan Bunn star as CBS Radio's The Couple Next Door. Now, starring John Daner, this is the story of J.B. Kendall, Frontier Gentleman.
Cheyenne, Wyoming Territory, had been good to me. And when I decided to leave, I informed the people at my hotel, packed my little bag of belongings, and dropped by Carrie Chase's office to thank him for his kindnesses. From there, I went to the stage station and made arrangements for my departure. Having several hours' wait, I took a last turn around the town. I thought I had visited all of the saloons in search of people and stories from my column in the London Times. I was wrong. I had missed Dan's Bloody Bucket, a scant 4 blocks from the center of town. I shall never forget Dan, nor his bloody bucket.
Oh, so you want to play dirty, do you? All right then, Mr. Dan.
The man shouting was small, wearing a derby hat pulled low over shaggy eyebrows. He was holding a gigantic cat in his left arm, while with his right hand he was tugging a length of chain from beneath the folds of a swallowtail coat. He was facing a great brute of a man. He was waving a broken whiskey bottle at him. Behind him, out of sight, another man was approaching with pistol butt raised. The odds against the little man were more than I could stand. Look out behind you!
Oh, dear, save thieves! A saint has arrived. Oh, no, you don't, blighter.
Hey, you want to get in this, stranger?
The troops has arrived, you shilly-shally mucky buck.
Man seems to need a friend.
You better move on, or what's going to happen to him will happen to you.
Oh, the devil, the cat, the princess, she's jumped out of my arms. Grab her, saint.
No, you won't.
Oh, no, you shouldn't have done that.
Grab him, Shake. Grab the stranger.
I'll get him. Oh. I'll get him right now.
Oh, you've done it, Saint, you've done it. Now grab the cat. I'll swing me chain over these two. Grab her!
What?
The princess, the cat, grab her, lad.
Who?
She's going by, Clubberhead.
Oh, yes. Here you go, princess.
Ah!
She's not friendly.
Well, grab her!
All right. Ah! Here now, cat princess.
Throttle her now and make friends later.
Stop it. I've got her.
Now let's get out of here. They're beginning to come around. Run.
Where should we run?
Out the door to me wagon. They won't never come near me chain. Now watch the cat. Don't let her get away. Now run. It's straight on with you. Now the cat. The cat into the box. Hurry.
There you go, lovey.
Hey, you come on, you high-roaring hump-tail. Hey, you.
It's Dan. He's shooting.
It's never again you'll see me, Dan, in the bloody bucket. Never. And the same to all of you. Son of corruption.
Six times a week, here at the Star's Address, you'll find that the shortest distance between two smiles is the Amos and Andy Music Hall. For one thing, there's always a sparkling tune or two to give your spirits a lift. The guest list reads like a textbook in applied astronomy. And of course, right at the heart of all the lighthearted things that happen at the Music Hall are the one and only two, Amos and Andy. Tomorrow and every Monday through Saturday on most of these same stations, listen for the Amos and Andy Music Hall.
The little man drove at a most fantastic rate of speed. I sat in silence atop the wagon seat, holding my hat down with one hand, while the other clutched the side for support. Our exit was punctuated by the princess hurling herself at my bottom side in magnificent rages, and I was thankful for the barrier of wood between us. In the bed of the wagon were numerous large crates full of cats of all sizes and colors. There seemed to be no one in pursuit, and after some minutes, the little man slowed the wagon, and without looking at me, he painfully lit a pipe. I presumed we were now somewhere in the barren area between Wyoming Territory and the Dakotas.
Perils. Perils of the trade, me boy.
I would say.
You've done a grand thing, lad. The princess there is the start of a whole new race, she is. I had to have her.
What? You mean the princess belonged to Dan?
And what did you think, huh?
Then I help you steal the cat?
Oh, tush. You merely laid Dan a blow he'll not be forgetting.
But you said grab the cat. I thought she belonged to you.
Don't let the technicalities bother you. It is a proper thing you've done.
I don't understand.
I supplied Cheyenne with her cats in the first place, and I reserve the right to have access, as it were, to their progeny.
I see. And if Dan pursues us, then what?
Well, if me luck holds, he won't find us.
And if it doesn't?
Never bother trouble me, lad. Look at me, lad.
Yes?
You have a bit of England in you.
Why, yes, as a matter of fact.
Me worst fears. What did you say your name was?
I didn't. It's Kendall. J.B. Kendall.
And I thought the saints had smiled. My name is Kerrigan, Shane Kerrigan, and you might as well have it straight out. I'm an Irishman. What's your business, Kendall?
I write stories concerning the West for the London Times.
Oh, that is a good town, London. I was there once when I was a mere boy. Good town. Too bad it's so full of the English.
Mr. Kerrigan, I'd be indebted to you if you'd tell me something about yourself for my readers.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Will you stop your blather, pussycats? Was on a bright summer morning when the birds sweetly sang on each bough that I first saw me Kathleen Mavornian as she sat a-milking her cow.
It's a miracle.
Now, Kendall, what it you wanted to know about?
Yes, this cat business of yours. I was going to ask, how does it work?
Oh, very simple. I'm on my way to save Deadwood at this time.
Save Deadwood?
I have 62 cats, 62 furry creatures in the proper positions, and the town will be rid of its varmints in a matter of hours.
And you intend to sell your cats?
That I do, at $10 a head.
People pay $10 for them?
Now, where have you been, Mr. Kendall? Do you not know that civilization rises or falls according to the number of cats in the towns and villages?
But I just never thought of it.
The great plague in Europe was due to the shortage of cats.
I suppose you're right.
Of course I'm.
Well, when you get to Deadwood, just how do you plan to go about the sale of your cats?
I have a staunch friend there, dear Margaret. I shall make my headquarters with this lovely lady, and soon the word will spread that I have arrived with my cats.
And will this lady appreciate your coming in with all this baggage?
It'll take a bit of doing, me boy, I don't deny that. But Miss Margaret has had an eye for Jane Carrigan these many years. Before 'tis done, she'll embrace me and me cats.
Yeah. Well, I'd rather like to ride along, if you don't mind.
Oh, 'tis welcome you are. Hey up there, little one. You've rested long enough. Come on, here.
Your horse. She seems to love her work.
That she does. Oh, 'twas on a bright summer morning. Oh, and the birds sweetly sang in each bough. That I first saw McPathlin. Uh-oh. That'll be Dan, the tenacious one. Hiya, girl, hiya! We'll give him a run for his dust.
I turned in my seat, and sure enough, it was Dan on horseback, accompanied by another rider. Mr. Kerrigan clamped his jaw on his pipe, leaned forward, and the wagon flew across the rocky ground.
Is he there, Kendall? Can you still see the Hayden?
Yes! He's closer! Jane! You might as well stop!
Stop! Are you daft? I wouldn't stop with the devil himself! Get along there! Hurry up!
Then it happened. A rock, half as big as the horse, loomed up in the road. Jane Kerrigan couldn't miss it.
Look out! We're going to hit!
Dan, do you ever see so many cats in the air at one time?
There's only one cat I'm looking for.
Oh, me heart. I've had it this time. Me heart can't take no more.
Are you all right, Mr. Kerrigan?
No, I'm dead and dying. The wagon's across me leg.
I came for my cat, you old goat. Where is she?
Kendall, how's me horse and cat?
The horse. Horse is all right, but the crates are broken and the cats are scattering.
Are you listening to me? I want that cat. She was the best mouser in Cheyenne.
Now, you see here. See here, Dan, whatever your name is. Can't you see this old gentleman is hurt? Now, give me a hand. We'll get the wagon off him.
You ought to do it, Dan. Your cat ain't worth killing, old fella.
I ain't helping nothing. It's a cat I come for, and I'm a-gonna get.
And I say you're going to help me. Here.
No, Kendall. Ah. Let him go. It's me dying wish he'd take the cat. Dan, you can see they've all scattered to the winds. Find yours and take her.
I'm going to do just that. Come on, Jake. Let's find her before she gets lost.
Wait! I'll need help moving this man.
No. Are you daft? What about the princess?
Well, the wagon box is still closed.
Oh, good.
What about you?
Well, the kind of help I need the likes of them can't give. Now, come on, give me a hand here.
All right, I'll try. Now, when I lift it... You try to pull yourself out.
Oh, yes.
How you doing? Out of there.
Oh, Kendall, she's bent. Oh, my leg is bad.
Yeah. Let me help you.
Oh, may I be forgiven an Englishman keeping me. It is more important to get the cats back. Now, break out the tripe and liver. They can smell it for miles. Then whilst they're coming in, we can make our repairs and be off for Deadwood.
Whatever happened to, what's his name? You know who I mean. That hypertense newsman who reported every wild rumor he ever heard.
Now, we don't know what happened to him, but we can tell you that reliable newsmen like Larry Lesueur, Lowell Thomas, and all of their colleagues at CBS News are still very much preferred by listeners everywhere. 5 nights a week, Larry Lesueur and Lowell Thomas broadcast the news on most of these same stations. Interestingly enough, their consistently accurate and carefully detailed reports provide much more excitement than cheap sensationalism ever could.
It was true. The tripe and liver could be smelled upwind, downwind, probably in Deadwood itself. The cats came streaming in. And with each group, I expected to see Dan and his friend, but we had seen the last of them. Mr. Kerrigan was considerably lamed by the accident, but managed to move about amazingly well. I made all the necessary repairs to the wagon and the crates, and by morning we were underway. We finally arrived at Deadwood, which had the look of all boom towns, a long, narrow street with wooden frame structures along the sides. The dwelling of Miss Margaret turned out to be a large saloon with upstairs lodging quarters. It was called simply Maggie's Place. You're certain this is it, Mr. Kerrigan?
Oh.
Aye, this is it. You go tell Miss Margaret, Jane Kerrigan is sick and wounded and needs lodging.
All right.
Lively with you now.
Howdy, mister. Can I help you?
Why, yes, I believe you can.
I think I'd like to. My name's Charlene. Have I seen you here before?
No, I don't believe so. I'm looking for Miss Margaret.
Miss Margaret? Sure you are. Hey, Maggie.
Yeah?
There's a fella here wants to see you.
Well, send him over.
Don't forget me. Charlene. Mr.
Kendall.
Kendall.
Yes.
That's Maggie over there. The big fat one at the end of the bar. I'll be around if you want to buy me a drink later on.
All right, Charlene. Thank you.
Max, you can change to the bad whiskey now. Nobody will know the difference. Well, hello, stranger. What can I do for you?
I'm looking for a lodging.
Not a chance. We've been full up for weeks. Ain't you heard about the strike at Gold Run Gulch?
No, I just arrived. No, this was for a friend of mine. He's outside. You know him, Mr. Chain Kerrigan?
Chain? Well, why didn't you say so? Charlene!
What?
Fix up the good room for a friend of mine and hurry it up.
Maggie almost cried at the sight of Chain cradled in my arms as I carried him up to the room prepared for him. There, lying back on the bed, he lifted a hand feebly toward me.
Oh, Kendall, good lad. Would you be about bringing up me luggage?
Oh, the poor, poor man.
You mean you want all...
Yes, all of them. And don't forget the rations. It's most important, lad. Now go.
Why do you bother the poor ailing man with his trivialities now? Bring up his baggage, as he says. There's a back way, and it won't bother no one.
Oh, Margaret, come to me, sigh. Oh,
yes, love. Now, what is it?
Are you sure I'm not imposing on you?
Well, now, what kind of a woman do you take me for?
Oh, Margaret, darling. It's worth the whole trip and trouble and the accident to my leg just to get back and look into your eyes.
Go to sleep, sweetheart. And you can have your friend Kendall right here with you.
Oh, no. It'll be rather crowded here. I can find a place.
Well, how can it be crowded? Two men in a big room like this?
Well, maybe not. I just hate to...
That's the end of it right now. I'll have another bed set in for you.
Thank you. That's very nice of you.
Look at him, Mr. Kendall. Poor man has fallen asleep. And we stand here, jawing in front of him. Come on, come away.
Oh, before you go, darling... would you be sending up 4 fingers of your best whiskey for my leg?
Well, of course. I'll have Charlene bring it right away. You can see, Mr. Kendall, nobody understands Chain Kerrigan like I do. I guess he's told you, hasn't he? The reason he's come back to Deadwood is to marry me.
Nobody saw me staggering up the back steps with crate after crate of cats. As for Chain, he busied himself drinking the liquor provided for him and instructed me to release and feed the cats. Eventually it was over and we finally got settled down, in a manner of speaking. But in the morning, the swarm had to be fed all over again. It's quite a job, isn't it?
It is a labor of love, my boy. Did Miss Margaret see you bringing our friends in last evening?
No, she didn't. But what do you plan to do about selling them now, crippled up the way you are?
I have a plan, Kendall, a wee bit of a plan.
Chain Love, it's Margaret with your breakfast. Can I come in?
Oh, please do, darling.
Well, did you sleep well?
Oh! What goes on here? Get out! Get out! Now, Margaret, you've lost control of yourself.
So this is the way you thank me, Chain Kerrigan. Well, you can get out, too.
What?
I'll not have this kind of a mess. Go on!
Margaret, come to me, side love.
I'll come to your side. I'll take an axe to you.
But it's my business, love, selling cats. I told you that when I was here before.
Yes, you told me. But I don't expect you to let him a place with them.
Possibly I could help in some manner.
You can, Mr. Kendall. You can open the back door for Chain Kerrigan and his cats.
Have you been told, lass, you're lovelier than ever when you're shouting like that?
Oh, get him out.
Margaret, now would you be allowing $620 to walk out the back way?
I don't care how much money you... What? How much did you say?
62 cats. Not counting the princess, of course. I could never sell her. She's my breeding stock. 62 cats at $10 apiece. That's $620. Now, Mr. Kendall, a man with that much money could support himself and a loved one for a good long time now, could he not?
Why, yes. I suppose he could, Mr. Kerrigan.
Margaret, sir, have you ever thought of marriage? A woman of your beauty and accomplishments?
Well, as a matter of fact, I... Chain, you're proposing to me, ain't you? I knew that's why you'd come back.
Now, when me leg heals and I'm able to get about and sell the cats, then I can make the plans closest to me heart.
Oh, Chain, I got an idea.
Oh, what is it, beauty?
I'll sell the cats for you.
No, you can't mean it. Now, how would you be doing that?
Why, they'll buy. They'll buy or else.
Who'll buy?
My clientele. I have a certain power here in Deadwood, as you know, Chain, and they'll buy from me.
Well, no. But if it wasn't for me leg, I wouldn't let you do this.
Oh, don't worry about your leg. By tomorrow, you'll have $620, and I'll have the preacher come by in the afternoon. Now, what do you say to that, Chain?
One thing at a time, Margaret. One thing at a time. Now, how would you be going about selling those cats?
That was the last I saw of Chain Kerrigan. I found a room for myself in town, lay on the bed for a moment, and, well, it was the next morning before I awoke. I rushed over to Maggie's place. Above her own sign, there was another one. It said, Cat Sale. Get yours now. On the door of the saloon itself, there was another sign saying, Closed. I knocked, and Charlene, the girl I had first met at Maggie's, came to the door.
Oh, hello, Mr. Kendall. I'm sure glad to see you this morning. But y'all better not come in.
What? Why? What happened?
Oh, come on. Let's walk down the street. It's about Mr. Kerrigan.
Has he died or something?
Worse. He's left.
Oh, well, then, that's good.
Oh, no, it ain't. He didn't wait for the wedding and say goodbye to Maggie or nothing. Just got his wagon and left.
What about his cats?
She sold them all last night. Gave him over $600. Why, you never seen so many men buying cats in all your life.
How's she taking it?
Oh, all right. Every time she feels bad, she counts her money again.
Her money?
Sure. She sold those cats for $15 apiece. Made over $300 for herself.
What? Why, that's marvelous. Charlene.
What?
You come on with me. I'll buy you that drink I promised you.
Why, Mr. Kendall.
Frontier Gentleman was produced and directed by Anthony Ellis. Tonight's script was written by Tom Hanley and stars John Daner as J.B. Kendall. Featured in the cast were Martha Wentworth, Charlotte Lawrence, Joseph Kearns, Barney Phillips, and Harry Bartell. Join us again next week for another report from the Frontier Gentleman. Bud Sewell speaking.
We heard episode 27 of Frontier Gentleman, The Catman, with an original air date of the 10th of August, 1958, starring another favorite and friend of the show, Mr. John Daner. My name is Arthur, and you have been listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org. Tufts Freeform Radio here in Medford. Stay tuned. The Shuki Wright Show will follow this program. And I don't know what I'm going to do next week. It's always up in the air until the weekend. But thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
COVID-19, WMFO DJs are pre-recording their shows for broadcast on air. We can still accept phone calls, but the phone line is in voicemail mode. Call 855-915-9636 and be sure to leave the DJ's name in the voicemail so we can forward it to the correct person. The following program was recorded earlier. Enjoy.
Good morning.